It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. A ceasefire in Yemen. Houthi fighters in Yemen say they have accepted a 5-day humanitarian ceasefire proposal from Saudi Arabia set to begin Tuesday. Sunday's announcement came just hours after warplanes and the Saudi-led coalition bombed the residence of former President Ali Abdullah Saleh in the capital Sana'a. Saleh was not believed to have been home at the time. Aid agencies report Saudi bombings and Houthi fighting have killed hundreds of civilians since March. The government of Central African Republic and 10 armed groups signed a peace deal Sunday. It is aimed at ending 2 years of fighting that's left thousands dead. UN negotiators say all sides agreed to formally disarm, give up using guns to settle their demands. The deal also includes an agreement not to use children as soldiers or forced laborers. Muslim rebels seized the CAR capital of Bangui in 2013, leading to often brutal attacks and reprisals between rival Christian and Muslim militias. German Chancellor Angela Merkel called on Russia Sunday to do more to urge pro-Russian separatists to abide by a ceasefire in eastern Ukraine and end fighting with Kiev's forces. Chancellor Merkel met with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow Sunday, where she paid tribute to Russian troops killed in World War II. Syria says Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu committed an act of flagrant aggression Sunday by crossing the border without Syrian consent in order to visit a historic tomb. The state-run Sana'a news organization says Mr. Davutoğlu was in grave violation of international laws and accords when he went to the tomb of Suleiman Shah, grandfather of the founder of the Ottoman Empire. This is VOA News. Macedonian President Jorge Ivanov says police prevented what he calls a coordinated terror attack after an armed group battled officers in northern Macedonia Saturday. The fighting in the city of Kumanovo left 22 people dead, including 8 police officers and 14 gunmen. 37 policemen were wounded. This week brings increased pressure on U.S. lawmakers to reform or reauthorize the National Security Agency's ability to gather domestic telephone records for anti-terrorist purposes. The program expires at the end of the month. VOA's Michael Bowman reports.
Patrick Leahy is the top Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee.
I believe we have to protect our national security, but we also have to protect our civil liberties, which make us unique as a country.
Exposed by fugitive former NSA contractor Edward Snowden, the program caused a firestorm when Americans learned of vast telecommunications monitoring by a shadowy U.S. agency. The program reportedly collects and stores phone records, but not the content of calls made. Michael Bowman, Washington.
U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson is warning the worldwide terrorist threat is entering what he calls a new phase, where media-savvy Islamist extremists are successfully attracting so-called lone wolf attackers to their cause. Speaking on ABC's This Week program, Johnson said the Islamic State group's influence is spreading far beyond the battlegrounds of the Middle East. He urged Americans to be vigilant and aware. Hundreds of thousands of people still remain without shelter and possessions following last month's devastating earthquake in Nepal. International organizations warn it is leaving poor women and girls desperate and vulnerable to human trafficking. Ron Corbin has details.
Non-government organizations, NGOs, say the criminal networks are especially targeting Nepal's rural communities, even using the cover of relief efforts to kidnap or lure women away. The United Nations says up to 15,000 girls are trafficked each year from Nepal, forced into sex work as far away as South Korea and South Africa, although the vast majority are lured to India, where thousands work in brothels. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
Liberia is celebrating the milestone of being free of the Ebola virus, but the country's president is urging the public to remain vigilant. One health official warned that Ebola remains active in neighboring Syria and Sierra Leone and Guinea. Cuban President Raul Castro visited the Vatican Sunday to personally thank Pope Francis for his efforts to end 5 decades of tensions between the U.S. and Cuba, which led to a resumption of diplomatic ties between the two countries. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, May 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Africa's main opposition and mostly white Democratic Alliance Party has its first black leader.
I myself hope that Mr. Maimane was elected because of his leadership qualities and not because he's black. It's an advantage that he's black, but I hope that's not the only reason.
Independent political analyst Harold Parkendorf of Johannesburg. South African authorities raided a church known for sheltering displaced foreigners. The World Bank labels Zimbabwe as one of the most unfavorable destinations in the world. And a Burundian official says about 90% of protests have been put down and opposition parties are lining up for next month's election.
I can assure you that everything is on the track. Now that all the opposition leaders understood that they have to pursue this electoral process.
Willy Nyamitwa is senior advisor on media and communication to Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza. East African youth conclude a week-long workshop on building sustainable peace in the region. And is Kenya growing more tolerant on its LGBT community? Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A political analyst says he hopes the first black leader of South Africa's main opposition and mostly white Democratic Alliance, DA party, will be seen for the leadership qualities he brings to the party and not because he's black. Delegates attending the DA's convention in Port Elizabeth on Sunday chose Musi Maimane to replace Helen Zille, who stepped down last month. Independent political analyst Harold Parkendorf says the election of Mr. Maimane is significant, particularly at a time when support for the ruling African National Congress has been declining among even black voters.
Well, it's an important step for the Democratic Alliance, which actually started in 1958 but developed over the years into the Democratic Alliance with about just over 1% of the voter support. And at the last election, that had grown to almost 23%. But all the leaders were all the time were mostly white. And then it started changing 4 or 5 years ago. And now we have a black leader, a young, charismatic, he's only 35 years old, Musi Maimane. And it comes at a very good time for the Democratic Alliance because the cry of the ruling party that we liberated you from apartheid is gradually no longer good enough to sell. So it's an important step. I myself hope that Mr. Maimane was elected because of his leadership qualities and not because he's black. It's an advantage that he's black, but I hope that's not the only reason.
Now, what is the black membership of this party, the Democratic Alliance?
I think about half of the people who voted for them were black. The important point to note about the local elections and the possible significance is that they don't control Cape Town anymore, the ANC, and they certainly bound to lose Nelson Mandela Bay, which is the old Port Elizabeth in the Eastern Cape, and it'll be a close run in three other major cities in the major province, Gauteng. So the next year will be very important for what happens in politics in South Africa.
Do you see the Democratic Alliance or someone from that party becoming president of South Africa soon?
Well, next year is only local government election, so he can't become president. But, you know, politics is a funny thing. Once a party begins to slide, then the fall comes fairly quickly. And as I said, the ANC has been sliding for the last 11 years. They're still at 52% nationally, but at local government elections, they're at about 50% in Johannesburg, the capital Pretoria, and on the East Rand industrial area. And they will certainly lose Port Elizabeth, Nelson Mandela Bay, which will be very significant. But whether they can sustain that into 2019 when the next election, national election is, still remains to be seen.
He said in a speech that South Africans are struggling under the burden of poverty, unemployment, and economic inequality more than two decades after the end of white racist rule. That's what he said. Can he deliver economically as a first black head of this party?
I think what he can do is he can say, look what we've done in the city of Cape Town, which is a well-run city with no corruption. He can say, look what we've done in the province of the Western Cape, which is the best administered province in South Africa. So I think he would at least have a better chance than the ANC has at the moment because it has ideological hang-ups. But solve the problems, no, but address them certainly.
Independent political analyst Harry Paukendorf was speaking with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. South African police and soldiers Friday raided Central Methodist Church in Johannesburg, known for sheltering displaced foreigners. Two people were arrested and 470 are currently detained by the Home Affairs Ministry in a nearby prison. As Gillian Parker reports, most are undocumented foreign nationals.
As dawn broke in Johannesburg, hordes of heavily armed South African police and army units arrived to raid Central Methodist Church. They carted off hundreds of illegal foreign nationals in armoured vans. The detainees are now waiting to be processed.
Everyone didn't pay anything. We just go on your own. Some they left their money. Their
gun-toting police entered the church shouting obscenities, calling people kukuwere, a derogatory term for foreigner, according to Lizzie Mambu, who has stayed at the church since she fled Zimbabwe several years ago.
We just hear the noise at 4 o'clock. They were breaking doors. Hey, wake up, wake up, wake up, wake up. Go to the ground floor. So we go here. We see a lot of police and soldiers with guns and Home Affairs. They said everyone must sit down here at the ground floor. So they didn't say anything. They just said, yeah, you are going back to your countries.
Police spokesman Lieutenant Colonel Katalego Mogali maintains that the operation was disciplined and organized and that nobody was injured. Blankets left on makeshift cardboard beds signalled a hasty departure for some 2,000 people staying in the church. Those who escaped the raid later returned to pack their modest belongings into large shopping bags with little clue of where to go.
I left Zimbabwe for the election. Afraid because my husband was the chairman for MDC. So ZANU-PF, you know, they want to kill people for MDC. So we leave Zimbabwe. We are staying here.
Johannesburg Central Methodist Church became a sanctuary for foreign nationals following a wave of xenophobic violence in 2008. The raids are part of the nationwide Operation Fiela, or Sweep Out Dirt. It is described as an anti-crime campaign, but rights groups said the operation is institutionalising anti-foreigner sentiment. Notices pinned on church walls the day before Friday's raid stated that following a theft in the building, the church had no choice but to evict everyone from the building. Those who were staying at the church argue that church members wanted them out at any cost. Bishop Indumezi Nkombo says that this is not the case.
I think the church have no problem with housing people who are genuine, who really are desperate for help. But while you do that, there are people who are going to hide behind that. The church was not happy, particularly about the element of crime.
Paul Varon, former bishop to the church, described the raid as beyond despicable, saying, "I know there are some difficult characters and some criminals. I'm saying deal with them, but you should be very careful that you don't treat everybody as if that's what they are." Gillian Parker for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza will meet today, Monday, with diplomats from the European Union as well as a delegation of the African Union. This comes as one person was reportedly killed on Sunday as protesters defied a government order banning street demonstrations over President Nkurunziza's decision to run for a third term. On Saturday, main opposition leader Agathon Gwasa, who has been critical of Mr. Nkurunziza, announced his candidacy to what he called Respect Burundi's Constitution and the country's electoral law. Willy Nyamitwa, senior advisor to President Nkurunziza on media and communication, said 8 opposition candidates have announced they will participate in the June election. He also said the government has been able to put down about 90% of protests.
The government has tried to clear the streets, and I can assure that 90% of the job is done now. In some areas, there are still some persons who are still protesting, trying to barricade the roads, but almost all the territory is now clear.
You said that a meeting is coming up Monday between what, the African Union and who? Tell us who is this meeting going to be with and what's the purpose?
Today, there is a meeting between the government of Burundi with the European Union ambassadors here in Burundi, but will be included also the United States ambassador in Burundi and the AU delegates in Burundi.
Prior to the delegation coming to Burundi, the chairperson of the African Union had remarked that the African Union was not going to send observers to Burundi if this election was held under this particular cloud. Now, have things changed in Burundi? Now, I'm hearing that the opposition leader, Agathon Rwasa, is going to now participate in the election. What does this mean now?
Yes, we know that opposition leaders were saying that they will withdraw from the electoral process. But now we have, for the time being, 8 candidates to the presidential election of June 2015. Because now they understood that Pierre Nkurunziza is the candidate of the ruling party, the CNDD-FDD, and it's the right for the party to appoint its candidate. So even those from the opposition parties are now dropping their candidacy. And for the time being, we have 8 candidates. And among them, we have 2 former presidents of Burundi, Sylvestre Ntibantunganya and Domitien Ndayizeye, and Mr. Agathon Rwasa.
So can you say that President Nkurunziza has been able to weather the storm now, that you think that everything has passed now and the elections can be on course?
He has always said that elections in Burundi have to come into realization, and that Burundians need elections in order to appoint authorities coming from elections, coming from the vote of the population. So now I can assure you that everything is on the track. Now that all the opposition leaders understood that they have to pursue this electoral process.
The allegation against the president that he's trying to force his way into a third term.
What I have to say is that we have the law with us. As a ruling party, I have to say that now that the Constitutional Court has said that he has the right to run again, so this means that anyone who wants him out, he has to push him out, but through the vote.
Willie Nyamitwa is Senior Advisor on Media and Communication to Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza. He was speaking with me from the capital, Bujumbura. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Monday, May 11th. Daybreak Africa time is 17 and a half minutes past the hour. Young people from across East Africa say they have a critical role to play in bringing peace and stability to the region. More than 100 youth have concluded a one-week workshop in South Sudan's capital, Juba, aimed at creating sustainable peace in East Africa. Mugumi Davis Rakarigi has the story from Juba.
The conference brought together young people between the ages of 18 and 35 from Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, Rwanda, Burundi, Somalia, and Ethiopia. Kenyan Zakaria Muturi works for Initiatives of Change, an international NGO that tries to transform society through changes in human motivations and behavior. Muturi says youth believe peace will lead to economic development across the region.
Nobody will want to come and invest in our region if we are not peaceful, because if we are destroying structures, we are fighting here and there, we cannot cooperate well, then that becomes a challenge for us.
According to the World Bank, 62% of the population of sub-Saharan Africa, or some 600 million people, are below the age of 25. This should translate into significant political influence for young people. But Muturi says the opinions of this age bracket in many African countries are often ignored by older adults. Abel Gazim Elzil Awadala, a participant from Sudan, says although they hail from different countries, young East Africans have a lot in common.
Yes, politically we are divided, but as the youth, we are together. And we continue doing this work of peace and meeting each other.
The United Nations Population Fund is also determined to send the message that young people matter. The organization believes youth should be given a platform because they'll be the leaders of the future. Participant Ingabire Painaina of Rwanda says she was touched by witnessing firsthand the devastation caused by South Sudan's ongoing conflict.
I was reminded of my own history. I was for the genocide, but I was also reminded that after that I can learn. No matter what we pass through, there is always like a light at the end of the tunnel. And as a nation, if we strive for what we want, we will always get it in the end.
South Sudan's Ayak Chol Deng Alak agrees. Deng Alak says she will leave the workshop with a message of tolerance peaceful coexistence and forgiveness for her countrymen.
You need to hear something over and over again for it to actually sink in. You need to hear words that become part of your thoughts that then, you know, transform into your actions. And that is what the Kenyan experience has brought to the table.
The Washington, D.C.-based Population Reference Bureau says Africa faces the enormous challenge of creating enough jobs to support its growing working-age population, especially the increasing number of young people. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
The World Bank has labeled Zimbabwe as one of the most unfavorable investment destinations in the world. In contrast, however, the International Monetary Fund recently applauded the Zimbabwean government for making progress in implementing its reform program. Economic commentator Masimba Kuchera says the government must restore the country's business image by first reforming the indigenization law.
The World Bank is looking at the time it takes to open a business in Zimbabwe, even after the one-stop shop, which was attempted by the inclusive government. Apparently, it still takes a lot of time to open a business. The perceived corruption within the country, the uncertainty in terms of the political winds of the country, but also, most importantly, the indigenization regulation are some of the hindrances, and they are some of the key reasons why people don't want to bring their money here. Remember, in business, perception sometimes becomes reality, and Zimbabwe is clearly failing to fight the perception. They feel it's a perception that they have not been able to sort themselves out insofar as some of the issues that I mentioned are concerned.
How do you reconcile statements by the IMF saying that Zimbabwe has made some progress in clarifying the indigenization laws and the World Bank ranking Zimbabwe very lowly in terms of business environment favorability?
I think the changes that the IMF talks about are only a small fraction of the problem that that is local in this country, especially with regards to the way politics is being managed and to the interaction between politics and business. So in this case, the World Bank is more on point in terms of looking at the practical needs and realities in terms of wanting to open a business compared to the IMF. If it is true, of course, that there has been some movement, we'll certainly then be able to see it after a few months. It's very difficult to restore business confidence, especially when those who destroyed that confidence are still the ones in charge.
That's economic commentator Masimba Kuchera speaking from Harare with Untungamile Nkomo of VOA Zimbabwe Service. The Kenyan High Court, ignoring objections from a number of politicians and cultural leaders, has ruled that a gay and lesbian organization should be allowed to officially register. Things might be improving for the LGBT community in Kenya, but as Hilary Hewler reports from Nairobi, plenty of challenges still remain.
When Kenyan lawyer Eric Gitari went to register his legal aid organization, the National Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, he was refused and told to find a less explicit name. Instead, Gitari took the matter to court. And to the surprise of some Africa watchers, he won. On April 25th, the Kenyan High Court ruled that the NGLHRC should be allowed to officially register. Human Rights Watch's Graham Reed says the judgment is an important victory, not just for LGBT rights, but for the Kenyan Constitution.
The judgment makes a very important point. Freedom of association cannot be limited on the basis of popular opinion, and also that subjective moral beliefs and subjective moral convictions cannot be the basis for limiting rights. The whole point of the Constitution is to provide protection to those people who would not be protected because of popular prejudice and discrimination.
The judges also pointed out that Kenya's colonial-era sodomy laws, which prohibit carnal knowledge against the order of nature, are vague. They questioned whether homosexuality was indeed against the order of nature. Gitari says he was thrilled by the decision, which promises to make it easier for gay and lesbian Kenyans to advocate for their rights.
It's like we've broken the walls of the dumb.
And what we are witnessing is a greater increased civic disposition and a greater agency by our clients. There's more confidence by queer persons in Kenya that they are included in this republic, that the constitution actually works.
But Kenya is a conservative country where homosexuality is still widely frowned upon. The court's decision has come under fire from politicians and religious groups. And Deputy President William Ruto said recently there was no room for homosexuals in his country. Guattari says that although rare, outbreaks of violence against homosexuals do still occur.
One of our clients was stabbed with a bottle on his chest. And despite being stabbed with a bottle, the police still arrested him instead of saving him and charged him with sodomy.
On the whole, says Guattari, Kenyans are actually growing more tolerant. A survey last year found that over 40% of Kenyans thought the government should be focusing on other things than legislating against homosexuality. Guattari says there's also been more support for LGBT rights in the local press. There's always a risk that the issue could become politicized, he adds, with politicians stirring up homophobia to win votes. Hillary Hewler for VOA News, Nairobi.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we focus on the South Africa Open Athletics Championships in Clokwe. Former Africa Women's High Jump champion Lisa Labiche improved her Seychelles high jump record to 1.92 meters when she won on Saturday. She's delighted.
I feel very, very excited right now because I jump very well. Without my coach didn't come, so I'm proud, and this record is for my coach.
You came into this competition with your 1.88 meter Seychelles record. Take us through it.
In a World Junior, I did 1.88, and then in 2013, I was out because I had a baby, and then I came out 2014 and 2015. Now, today, I did my record, and I'm so happy. I was not thinking that I would break the record again, because people, when I was pregnant, they put me down and discouraged me to not continue athletics, but I came out strong and I know I can do more better than that. It felt great to pass 192.
And then after that you tried 195.
Yes, but I didn't make it, because now if I jump too much, my ankle will be so swollen that I couldn't barely walk, so I will try it again later.
From here, what do you plan to do?
Train hard and improve my record again.
That was Lisa Labiche, the Seychelles 2012 World Junior Championship Women's High Jump Silver Medalist, speaking in Clokwe. Meanwhile, South African Roscoe Engel bettered his 200-meter lifetime best twice with winning times of 20.56 and 20.51 seconds. His confidence is high.
Well, I knew I had to push through the bend, especially in my semi-final. As soon as I pushed out the bend, I knew there was a PB. It was just a matter of holding out in the straight. Then the final, I knew I had my workout out again. I thought I was going to lack energy, but at the moment I'm recovering quite well. Pushed out the exit, same story. I was longer into the straight, and it's another PB. I'm so happy.
You're very close to the World Championship qualifier at both events, and with these two PBs on one afternoon in a space of less than 2 hours, going forward, what are your thoughts?
I know that I have to quicken my bend ever so slightly, work on speed endurance a bit more. I'm pretty confident about hitting the time to qualify. I don't think that's an issue. It's just a matter of running more races over the two.
South African sprinter Roscoe Engels speaking in Clokwe. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Clokwe, Northwest Province in South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The government of the Central African Republic and 10 armed groups signed a peace deal Sunday aimed at ending 2 years of fighting that has killed thousands. That is it for this Monday, May 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer David Van Dee, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post editor Mark Oman, I'm James Butty, Washington, saying have a lovely day, Africa.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me every weekday evening for Africa News Tonight from the Voice of America. It's a thorough summary of the day's events, featuring interviews with the people making news in Africa. You'll hear every side of an issue. And of course, Sunny Young drops by with the sunny side of sports. Plus, we have special features on science, business, Africans abroad, and comments from listeners like you. So please join me every weekday for Africa News Tonight from the Voice of America.